Hello, welcome to the latest episode of the Minorities in Publishing podcast. For new and returning listeners, you may know you can find the podcast on iTunes as well as Tumblr at minoritiesinpublishing.tumblr.com and on Twitter at minoritiesinpub. And I'm very happy to have fellow podcaster for Introvert Problems, Amani Josie, and she is also the author of The Blazing Star, as well as her short story, Crown, recently came out and is available for free, she told me, because I was going to tell y'all to buy it, but, you know, you can, I'm sure she has, like, a Patreon somewhere you can contribute to.
I'm telling you, if you want to give me money.
Well, you've also done work online as well as building up the presence of other female writers, Black female writers online for the work that they're doing. You've been a wonderful literary citizen, and I'm really happy to talk to you about the work you're doing, your gorgeous book, The Blazing Star.
Oh, thank you.
And just like the unique stories that you're telling and how you're pursuing them. So it's funny because your background is so specific, and I know I speak to...
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's not all, but it's just like, oh! And I want you to talk about it. I don't want to spill it, but...
It's all over the place. Sometimes I forget my life.
Well, that gives you...
specific in certain places, and then I just do a 180 until someplace
else. But that gives you material, right?
It does. I didn't realize that when I was doing most of these really odd, random things, but now that I'm, you know, more focused on my writing, I'm like, oh, I have a wealth of material.
You do. You do. And you started doing playwriting, so I was wondering why fiction, but specifically why young adult fiction?
I really got into playwriting when I was in high school as my creative writing teacher. That was the first thing he taught, and I love dialogue, and it was just a really natural fit. YA didn't come around until, for me, after grad school, which is about 5 or 6 years ago for me now, and I was just really getting into it. In my early 20s, I had a string of really bad jobs, really boring jobs. Sometimes I'd, like, sneak, and I'd download the most popular book, I'd buy the most popular book, and at that time, it was YA starting to boom, so I was, you know, Twilight and Hunger Games, and stuff like that. And I was also getting into historical fiction because I'm kind of a history nerd. So after grad school, I really wanted to take my writing more seriously, and it kind of became a natural marriage where I really liked making voice-driven pieces, my interest in the YA genre, and then adding some history and some fantasy. And so we have The Blazing Star.
Well, I also want to talk about because of the path you took to publish The Blazing Star.
Yeah, that was pretty unique, and it's been very entertaining for the last 5 years. I think that's a nice way to put it, been very entertaining.
You use the word entertaining the way I use the word interesting.
Yes, very coded. Exactly. A lot of stuff packed into that word. When I was in grad school, I just started putting some scenes together. I had a story in my head for a very long time, and when I started reading more YA, I thought maybe this could actually work into something. Mm-hmm. So then when I was in grad school, I started putting some scenes together, and afterwards, again, found another really bad job where I could just do all my work really, really fast, and then I would sneak and start writing on my breaks and stuff like that, and I strung all the sentences together, and I looked up, and I had 55,000 words, which were outside of writing, it sounds like a lot, but that's, you know, nothing. But it was enough to have a story. I knew I needed to have it edited. So I went through the entire process of finding beta readers and editors and that sort of thing. I was like, just like all authors, I'm going to get traditionally published and I'm going to be the next insert whatever mega super famous person who writes name is. And when I started querying, I got a lot of pungent interest, but then I would get back the coded rejections, the I don't connect with the voice rejections, and it was driving me insane. It was literally driving me up the wall. And my last straw, when I had this agent who had been just glowing about my book for like an entire year, and then she sent me back, finally after I harassed her, sent me back my rejection letter. It ended up being 4 pages of things she loved and wanted to change, but then was like, ultimately, this is too much work for my list.
You waited a year for that?
A year for that. I was already working with a boutique agency who helped me get really great editors on the, you know, I wasn't querying something that was completely wrong. It had really great editors on it. My project manager at Wise Inc., who's my publisher now, is a literary agent. It went through some rigorous stuff. They kind of like sent me on the wild for a year to do my querying. And after that last agent rejected me, I called them up and I was kind of telling them what I was going through. And one of the things that I do really appreciate about Wise Inc. is a very diverse staff. And one of the co-owners is actually an African-American woman. Mm-hmm. And we were having a conversation. And I was telling her what I was, you know, getting in feedback. She's like, you know what, Imani, to be really frank about this, you can go back and we can work on some more editing and whatever else you want to do. But do you want to wait another 5 years? At that point, I've been at like a 4 or 5 year mark of trying to get this thing done. She said, you want to wait another 5 years? I said, no. And so we went into production with The Blazing Star that instant. And some months later, it was out and published in December of 2016. That was my road.
But it sounds like yours is a bit different from the quote-unquote traditional self-published person who literally might go out, maybe find some feedback, and then go on CreateSpace.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
No, that's really... really fair point to make also. When I say I had a lot of feedback and agent response and rejection during my year of querying, I'm talking about 100 plus. I think it's really valuable, you know, not to kind of be reactive, even though my story might sound a little bit reactive, but not just to limit yourself to, hey, you know, F traditional and I'm just going to do this here. There's definitely value in seeing what's going on over there and meeting the people who are doing it traditionally. And then there's a lot of value also in circulating with your fellow indies. So I like to say I mean, my mentor is traditionally a published author, so I got both sides. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, because you're also, you're working with Wise Inc., right? W-I-S-E-S-E.
Yeah.
Okay. So you're working with Wise Inc. You also have a publicist. So you're taking it very much like the business end, kind of like how Brooke Obi and Zeta Elliott, who I've also had on the podcast, have done. You know, like they've looked at it as business. It's not, I wrote a book and now I'm going to publish it. What happens next? It's no, I'm a business person. I'm invested in my craft. And so I'm doing this. Because I kind of want to also note that self-publishing is a route that good writers take. You know what I mean? It's a route that good writers who know what they want to do and appreciate the process and want to sell themselves take. It's not just the kind of last-ditch effort.
Yes. I think a lot of people, because they'll see, you know, some sort of video on YouTube or something like that, or some person, I made $1 million off of my book. They think it's a get-rich kind of quick scheme. And self-publishing, it's definitely a business. And it's funny you said that because I posted on my Facebook today. It's like writing the book is an art. Publishing and selling the book is a business. You are investing your time and your money and trying to, one, get people to appreciate your art, but two, get people to pay for it. You are making an investment in yourself. And of course, we all like to see a return on our investment.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, it's not something that you want to take lightly. And Laura, who's my project manager, I talk about her all the time, but she said to me as soon as, this is even before we started in the indie publishing process, but in just the process of editing, so I was learning, she's like, everything about publishing is hurry up and wait.
Oh my God, yes.
Hurry up and wait. And all of the lovely books that people have received, I purchased those up front. So this is an investment. But when you have a quality product, don't be afraid of that investment either. That's the other side.
That's true.
You got a quality product. You put that time in the craft and then also in the marketing and the production. That's why I went with Wise Inc. because they make beautiful indie books. I wanted to look like a book that could be in Barnes & Noble. If you put that time in, then be confident in yourself.
I'm sorry to obsess about this cover, but...
It's okay.
Because when I saw it, I remember it was in one of these Facebook groups I was in, and someone was like, oh, Imani Josie's The Blazing Star. And I was like, oh, that's gorgeous. That's so good. Oh, my God. And then hearing more about you and saw you did some Twitter chats, and I was just like, that's self-published?
Uh-huh.
I was like, get the hell out of here. And I'm like, sorry about that stigma. But I was just like, oh my God, that looks professionally done. And automatically, because I am I'm a judger of the book cover. I am the person that judges the book by its cover and the copy. Of course, the content as well, but it's such an eye catcher. And it was just so, it wasn't overdone. It wasn't underdone. It wasn't literally kind of clip art and cut and paste. And you kind of block colors and just made no sense. And you could just tell it was someone's high school project. And I was like, no, this is good. I was like, this is so good. This is big five quality.
I will tell Steve, he kicked the ass with that cover. He did.
And I totally got it. When I looked at that cover, I said, oh, yeah, I can totally tell what this is about. And then when I read the copy, I was like, yeah, the cover really does match it. And it puts a black woman front and center.
Yeah.
So that should have really tipped me off that it wasn't a publisher. Because there was a black girl front and center. And I should have been like... Publishers don't do that.
I know. So I did the cover reveal for Blazing Star on my birthday, which was last September.
Mm-hmm.
It was a great day to do it because obviously you get a lot more traction to your website or Facebook and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And I have been with Steve, with Laura, and everyone in production every cycle that we went through with the cover. We probably started like around last May or something, last April. So I knew it was a pretty cover. But when I put that thing out, my Twitter went insane.
Mm-hmm.
It was the closest thing to going viral I've ever experienced. It became a thing in itself. And I was sitting here scrambling on the back end trying to get my Goodreads page up and all this other stuff because I just thought we're going to put it out and my family's going to be like, oh, baby girl, that's so pretty. I'll give you $20, you know. And I have people talking to me like, I need to add you to my Goodreads. I need to add you to my TBR. I need to do all this stuff. Who are you? What is this? I didn't even get it as an indie. They just wanted, what is it? What's going on? It was, and I talked to people later about it. Because people come to me and they've told me that it's the prettiest cover they've ever seen. They're amazed that there's a black woman on the cover and that sort of thing. I just was not prepared for the response to that cover. But that's the nice thing about going indie because you can have so much control over those things. Mm-hmm. I won't say I was 100% in control because I also do believe in professionals be professionals. Mm-hmm. I am a Virgo control freak, but, you know, I'm paying this much money for this product because I trust the people who are helping me create it. So I kind of felt like the few covers that I've seen with African-American women or girls, they're kind of like none in YA in particular, they aren't pretty covers. Mm-hmm. They can be gritty or emotionally compelling, but they're not pretty. And I really wanted this to be pretty. I tell you, Steve just knocked it out of the park. When we got it back, the response was just really mind-blowing. I'm so humbled by it. But I want the girl to have natural hair on the cover because it's going back in time to ancient Egypt and she ain't got a relax in her head. Whatever. That press curl ain't gonna last. So it's realistic.
She got too much to worry about. She don't need to worry about products.
Hey, you know. She ain't gonna find no present girls. We play with that. Yeah, what is that? There's a new YA book that was written by a white woman, but people were up in arms about it on Twitter.
Yes, I forgot her name already.
Yeah, and I can see the title. I can see the cover because it was the first YA book.
Yeah, and it was relaxed. Her hair was relaxed, wasn't it?
Exactly.
Now?
That's what I saw. This is how you can tell. It's not we noticed. Look at this. Ain't nobody pressing that hair.
Yeah, I don't know if it's future or I honestly don't. I think it's fantasy. That's as much as I know about it.
Fantasy, and I can't even think of the name. I can just see it because she has on this kind of salmon colored dress. It's like, yes. It's a pretty cover, but yeah. I saw that so many times on Twitter and I was cracking up. She wouldn't be doing that.
Yeah, that was a big to-do. I remember because previous guest, Danielle Clayton, kept getting tagged. She kept getting tagged. I felt so bad for her because she's just like, my Twitter's blowing up.
Oh, and it's not my book. Yeah, I saw because a lot of the commentary was that they were taking that verse away from her, which...
Yeah. Which is...
Publishing.
Yeah, but it also kind of disappoints me because someone did bring up a good point, which is Well, actually, self-published people have done this. Self-published black people and self-published white people have been putting black girls on covers for fantasy.
I mean, we just kind of get a bit of the stigma with indie. And I think that's it was an interesting thing when my book hit, because a lot of people couldn't tell that it was indie, which is, you know, great. But also, I don't think that the stigma should be there, because I have a lot of friends who have beautiful books, fantastic books about black women, about black girls, and shouldn't be relegated to some sort of corner because they're not traditionally published, or if other authors don't think mm-hmm. we bought tickets to speak on the same platform as they do about our books.
I mean, it also deviates from the larger conversation, which is what is the content, and let's support the people of color writing about people of color doing the work. So let's stop focusing on the white woman. But not to say that's not a significant argument, but let's stop giving her more press and attention and give y'all's attention who've been doing this already. Because I was sitting there like, wasn't the Blazing Star? They were like, no, it's not traditionally. We're talking about traditionally published books. And I said, why? Why are we only talking about traditionally published books?
So there's still the thought process that only traditionally published books are the ones that have the credibility, that mm-hmm. are the real ones that should be put in front of our children, that sort of thing. And it's utterly ridiculous.
It is.
I think as we're moving in the future, having more of a hybrid experience is going to be the norm mm-hmm. for a lot of authors. Mm-hmm. It kind of makes me think, you know who Chance the Rapper is?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And look where he is now.
Yeah, he's huge. And I was listening to this interview he was doing, and he was talking about how he believed that the future was heading toward an independent experience for artists, musical mm-hmm. artists. He's saying that, like, the normal things for artists to sell their masters, and he has his masters, he has all rights. He said he definitely feels that eventually artists are going to be looking at artists of the past like, you used to sell your masters? Mm-hmm. Are you crazy? I can definitely see publishing going in the same direction.
That's a big regret by the surviving Beatles, that they don't own their masters.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and you know, when you're starting out, and any type of artist, you're usually young and hungry and poor. Mm-hmm. And so when someone comes around and they're like, hey, here's $5,000, give me all your intellectual property, you're like, yes, $5,000, this is amazing. Until a month later, and you're like, man. Can I please have back my rights? I'm actually not the first published author in my family. My grandfather is a very well-known historian, wrote a book called Before the Mayflower, and he would be considered small press. The book is, I mean, they taught the book, I went to Howard, they taught the book in every Black history class I was in, but he doesn't own the rights to his masters. I mean, that's traditional publishing for you. You're signing over your rights. Don't ever forget the business aspect of this. You're definitely signing over those rights.
And if you don't earn out that advance, it's very hard. It's so many layers to it. It's so many layers. But let's get back to the Blazing Star. Because that's important.
And my book, baby.
Well, it's funny because when I was digging more into it, too, I don't know if you were part of that conversation or you saw it online last week. And people were kind of up in arms because they're like, how dare people ask the question of black people in particular, if you could go back in time in history, where would you go? And people said, there is no time in history when we were safe. You know, because everyone's thinking slavery,
of
like,
course.
Like there's no time for us to be. But you did write a historical novel with a black lead, and it's time travel.
Yep.
And you decided to go to ancient Egypt. So I'm kind of interested in the context of the story itself, and in choosing ancient Egypt in particular.
And I missed that conversation, but I wish I had been in on it.
Someone who was white started it. I'm pretty, the way people were reacting, it was like, how dare you ask us where we would go in history? And I said, well, I'm pretty sure on the continent we might have been okay.
Well, one, I told you I really like history. History is really, really interesting to me. I probably got that from my grandfather, because mm-hmm. history's up. I chose ancient Egypt because, well, my mom had all these pictures when I was a kid, and I actually stole one, borrowed this picture of Nefertari, who's a cop, for the second, and she used to keep it in my bedroom, and I stole it, and it's in my house now. And I was always fascinated with it. I thought it was just really pretty, a Google picture. It's like on my Instagram, if you go all the way back a year ago. I just thought it was really interesting. And when I was reading historical fiction more in my mid-20s, I was reading a lot of historical fiction about Rome, about Greece, and about Egypt. And what I thought was really interesting is that I wanted to explore the area and what Egypt meant to all the people who were being affected by Egyptian rule. And I didn't want to go back to Greco-Roman ancient Egypt, Cleopatra Egypt, that sort of thing. I wanted to go back to Middle Kingdom Egypt, and even before that. And I wanted to talk about, because like there's a large Arabic connection, but there's a very large African connection, because you obviously have media, which is like, you know, I live in Chicago, media is like in Indiana, you know, like 30 minutes out, that sort of thing. And so this book's actually going to be a series. And in the second book, we are going to the northern part of Egypt in the Delta. And then third one, we're going to be in ancient Kush. Ooh. And I wanted to talk about kind of all the stuff that you don't get to see. I love watching the bloggers react, because at first when people saw the book coming out, they're like, I love Egypt. I'm an armchair Egyptologist. Oh my God, I love Egypt. I can't wait to read this.
I saw Cleopatra.
Exactly. And then when I put it out there, I purposely took most of the, because a lot of stuff that we understand about ancient Egypt is through the eyes of the Greeks and Romans, right? And I purposely took most of that stuff out and left the actual African names of Egypt in. I left a few things just for recognition purposes. So I just left a few things in there that just were purposes of being recognizable, but most of it I took out and replaced it with the actual African terms. I did a lot of research for the book. I actually got a lot of flack from bloggers for saying I have too much description in there because I'm a nerd, but I wanted to explore it, and I wanted to explore what these ancient people would look like to a 16-year-old, a modern 16-year-old black girl.
Because it's such a unique story, because from the And I'm thinking specifically from the African-American perspective. Yeah. I think when we think of history, and maybe this is just an American thing, is that we think of our history. We don't think of the ancestors in terms of pre-European colonization, like you're saying. So this is such a unique story. And I'm glad it's out in the world. And I'm just kind of like, wow, yeah, we don't have those. It's literally slavery. your history is slavery. That's your history. And it's just like, okay.
There are really some wonderful stories that delve into our experience with slavery. I've actually, some of the other fantasy stories that I've written have more to do with the Reconstruction era and like that World War I era stuff.
Yeah.
I think it's kind of interesting, and people don't really talk about when it comes to black history. Like, we really, when it comes to black history, we get the antebellum South, you know, right before the Civil War ended, like 1861. That's when that's the kind of stories that we get explored. And then we also get civil rights movement of the mid-century. We act like there's no other one African-American experience. And then we act like there's no other Pan-African experience.
Yeah.
So we have a very long history. I mean, even diving into, you know, ancient Egypt's culture, 6,000 years old. Conceptually, that's insane. So, Cleopatra, the one that we think of, the one that was the Taylor play, Cleopatra the VII, she's like 3,000 years old to us. She was born she was reigning about 60 years before Jesus. To her, the Great Pyramids of Giza were 3,000 years old already. This is a very, very old culture that didn't change that much. There's a lot to explore besides stuff that people know about Egypt, and then just in general with the content. Like, I can't wait to go into media. That's gonna be exciting. Yeah, I just wanted to give a little history with a little modern twist that people weren't expecting.
Is book two almost ready?
Yeah, so book two is in production. We're looking at like a February release.
Black History Month.
Hey, now, you know how we do. I'm a marketer, too. No, okay, not really.
You'll be in good company.
Yeah, I know Danielle's coming out too in February.
Yeah, Renee Watson's next book is February.
Yes.
So is the cover...
It's in production. I'm getting my butt kicked right now in edits.
Okay.
It's in production. We're going to start cover production soon too.
Ooh.
I know. I can't wait.
I'm excited. I want to see this theme. For these covers.
You know, you said earlier that you're a cover snob, and I am too. It was one of the reasons why I started working with why I think I work with them because, well, first, I'm a website snob, and I like the website. So I was like, okay, if they have enough wherewithal to have a nice website, then they'll probably be into details enough to make the rest of what I'm looking for to be great. To me, one, as somebody making something, but also something as an active reader, like, how can I ask you to purchase something that I wouldn't? If I can't look at the product and be like, yeah, I buy that, I can't have you to spend your hard-earned $15 on a little book. That's not right to me.
But it's also a taste thing because I feel as though with certain aesthetics, people just get the aesthetic. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like they get how to market that.
Yeah.
And some people don't.
Yeah. Well, you know,
some people just don't.
A lot of traditional artists say this too, but marketing, you know, they give you the book, but like, marketing, all that stuff, that's you.
Like, it is.
That's your drive.
It really is. So, keeping it real.
I try not to be so blunt. But
no, but it's important because I think with self-publishing, you're doing everything, right? I spoke with Brooke and Zeta, that you're doing so much yourself. And then when you have a traditional publisher, they're kind of guiding you and like, we know what's best. And sometimes they do. Sometimes you're right. The way you plan this out works better. But at the end of the day, your publisher can do but so much.
Yes.
And if you are not because they're going to look at the next book, but you're also looking at your next book, but you're not forgetting your first book.
Yeah. When you're writing a series, another form of masochism. Like, what the chapter 6 in the first book? I don't know. What color were this person's eyes? I don't know.
I can forget halfway through book 1. I was like, oh man. Were they muscular? Were they lean? What were we saying? What did we say?
Why am I so descriptive? Please make these people general. Yeah.
Paint by numbers. Make this paint by numbers.
Yeah, but you're doing everything. You're an artist, but remember that meme around Thanksgiving time. You're the beans, the greens, tomatoes, the ham, the hog. You are all that. You're the financier. You are the person with the vision for your marketing. Like all that stuff. Well, I think that's a really great job. They've been a top product for me and all that stuff. The PR stuff, that's me. Mm-hmm. All the marketing, the posts, email blasts, podcasting. That's all me.
And how do you manage it all? I mean, sometimes that's a loaded question. It is a loaded question.
How does she do it?
How do you balance all this? And it's kind of a bullshit question and that I don't.
I have weekly nervous breakdowns. Thank you for asking. Yeah, I try to be kind to myself. I was telling you, I'm kind of a control freak Virgo, and I am kind of regimented. But then when I can't hit something or I forget something, I just try to be nice to myself and go eat some chocolate and watch The Real Housewives or something and call it a day. Because, Dan, you are one person. You can't do everything. You're not omniscient. You are one person. Uh-huh. But that also comes with the idea of find help, find helpers. I was really fortunate that I was already working with a photographer who taught media studies at a local college here. And I was, because I've been working with him since I was in pageants and kind of boo-hooing to him. And he was like, well, you know, we have an internship program here where you can get interns and give them college credit for working with you. Ooh. I was like, bet. Here is a description. And I got 2 interns last year, like doing the crazy stuff of producing The Blazing Star and getting that ready. It helps so much. So that I could really focus on things that I needed to focus on. So I do have really good people around me helping me also.
Good. Yay. Yes. I'm glad to hear
yes.
that.
Yes. Find interns. Love them.
Treat them well.
Yes, treat them. I'm telling you, treat them well.
So you also have your standalone short story out now, Crowned, which yes. I had the pleasure to read. And yes. you contributed to the Hidden Youth Anthology for Speculative Fiction. And that was kind of like a sequel, kind of, to The Long Hidden, but it focused on youthful protagonists.
Yep.
It seems like you have a knack and interest for short stories in this genre that I feel like we've been seeing the anthology boom. Have you been seeing this? Especially mm-hmm. like something, a new anthology is announced every week mm-hmm. in the kidlit sphere, which is a little ridiculous. Somebody tells us like, holy crap, there's another anthology.
It does feel like a boom, doesn't it?
It really does. I mean, even as early as last year or 2 years ago, I mean, Hidden Youth is not done traditionally either. It became something because of the power and popularity of Long Hidden. Now that you're seeing this boom, do you feel like short stories are a good entry point for people to get to young readers in any way?
I don't know about young readers. I do think that short stories and anthologies are a really great way to hone your craft. I honestly didn't really have much interest in short stories and anthologies until my mentor started bugging me. And I saw that my mentor had one out all the time. But then she recommended Hidden Youth to me when they were taking submissions. I was like, I'm going to try this. And I loved the whole process of creating a short story. And I really loved Hidden Youth for their criteria, which felt like it was just calling to my soul. They said that the submissions, it has to have element of magic. It has to have a character who is 18 or younger. Mm-hmm. Or main character, 18 or younger, and the story has to be set before 1935. It's like, oh, you are speaking to my soul. I'm gonna write this. And I wrote it in the story that I wrote for, it's called North. It was a really personal story for me because I was kind of doing a family history project. I was doing a lot of work on my great-grandmother at that time, and she ended up becoming the protagonist of North. My great-grandmother, and it's a story about essentially the first wave of the Great Migration, the mm-hmm. World War I generation going up. And it's a romance, a paranormal romance. And I just thought her story was so interesting. She left Huntsville, Alabama in 1918. And she kind of came from an affluent family. She left all that and she went to Detroit. And then my great-grandfather, who was like a year or two younger, he's kind of like a little pipsqueak guy. He's like short. Mm-hmm. And he followed her up there. And they started a branch with my family that's from Detroit. And I just thought there has to be a love story there. They're mm-hmm. fascinating. And I kind of just wanted to explore what was going on at that time, adding in the love story. And it became more, right? Short stories. But what I will say, what I thought was kind of interesting byproduct of writing short stories and getting those accepted and published, that kind of lent a little bit of credibility. I kind of felt like to my writing, I started meeting more authors who were just in different veins of publishing than I was. And people outside were much more receptive. I won't say they weren't receptive to me from the Blazing Star. I think, what are you? What did you do? How is this indie? How is this? What is that? Mm-hmm. And then when I started getting short stories traditionally published and things that people could understand, then I got a lot more warm welcomes. Oh, I'll put it that way. Uh-huh. That was kind of an interesting byproduct for me of having traditionally published short stories.
So you have Crowned Out, and that is about a young woman who pursues a teen beauty pageant with natural hair.
Yes. And it was so crazy because Miss USA was yesterday, and DeShauna Barber came out with her natural hair. She used the former Miss USA. She was crowning the next one, but the one who did win, named Kara, I think, and she also wore her natural hair. So we have a natural hair former winner crowning another natural hair winner. I was like, is this the Twilight Zone? This is insane.
Hit that story even harder now.
I wanted to write a pageant story, and mm-hmm. I want to write more about pageants also, because I did pageants for 7 years, mm-hmm. and I competed in 12 pageants, and I won 6. And I wanted to explore what that experience is like as an African-American woman. You get some understandings of what it's like to win. I don't know, I'm trying to think of something else that's been written about being a Black woman in pageant. Like, I know Tammy has a book coming out, Tammy Charles, but I think it's called Like Vanessa, which I'm excited to read. But it's a very interesting experience being a Black woman competing in pageantry. And I didn't compete with my natural hair, which I'm sad about now.
Oh, yeah.
That I'm older. I wish I had, but I did wear a natural when I was in high school. So I just try to imagine what it would have been like competing in high school, because I competed in college and right after, but competing in high school with a natural, and what that would have been like for a young lady, the kind of courage that it takes to do that. Having our femininity, what football is to masculinity, is like hyper aggressive form of it. And unfortunately, the beauty standard that a lot of pageants, mainstream pageants particularly, adhere to is not one that celebrates African American women, which is why we often do not wear our natural hair in a mainstream spotlight. So I kind of want to touch on like microaggressions that you experience when you're a Black woman in pageantry, what that makes you feel about yourself, and how Black girls essentially express themselves when they get up on that stage. Mm-hmm.
Do you think you'll do a full book on this?
I think I will. I just don't think I will do it in YA. It might be NA. Just because I didn't do teen pageants.
Okay.
I started in like more of a miss. So it would probably, I'd probably have to grow the character up and put her in college and right after. Mm. So that was my experience, and it was interesting.
I can only imagine. Just watching those shows, what is it, TLC or whatever? It's more
toddlers
about the stage.
And tiaras,
yes.
And all that crazy stuff.
It's terrifying. But it's also because they're so young. They're just like, a child that is four should not have that much makeup on and that much hairspray.
I know. I wanted to do it when I was a kid. My mom was like, hell no. That was like JonBenet Ramsey time too. So she was like,
oh my gosh.
No. So I had to kind of literally wait so I could put myself into a pageant. If I have a daughter one day and she wants to do pageants, I won't put her into like any kind of kids pageant. I would wait until she actively decided to be in a pageant. Because it's just kind of a difficult form of competition. Not the form of competition, I put it in the story, it's not the kind of competition like track, you know, where the best person wins, or like basketball. It's completely subjective. And any given Sunday, a different person could have won. The outcome could be different. And it's really hard to explain to a grown woman, let alone like a 7-year-old. That can be kind of damaging.
Wow. Yeah.
It's very difficult to explain to a kid. So I'd definitely wait to be emotionally mature enough to understand the kind of competition you're getting into. But it's not one that I wouldn't tell people to get into either. Because I think it prepared me actually the most for the book process than anything. I owe a lot to pageants.
Yeah, I could see the correlation, absolutely, of being like, this is what I want to do. I know I want to do it. And I know these are all the steps to be successful.
Fashion girls are super ambitious. They are very ambitious. And you kind of think about pageants like, oh, yeah, I'm going to walk across stage and smile and wave and wear a lot of makeup. But there's a lot that goes into that day. By the time they get to that day, they've already fundraised. They've already advertised. They already have a website. They've already cleaned their Google up, their social media up. They've already done appearances. They've already mock interviewed. They've already prepared a resume and essay. These girls are ready to go to Congress. To be kind of fairly honest, kind of preparation. On top of that, they're hungry and they need a cheeseburger and they're ready to get this over with. These girls have binders. They are prepared and ready. And I kind of take the same mentality into indie publishing of having that, my binder ready and knowing everything that I wanted. And I know I want my cover to look like this. You know, like, you got to do it.
And knowing you're going to be judged before you walk in that door.
You're going to be judged. Once they anticipate how you're going to be judged, you know how to make that work in your favor.
Exactly. See, businesswoman. Business.
From books to pageants to crazy people on Twitter.
That would be an awesome training ground and be like, oh, you want to get published? You need to do a pageant.
Get your sequins ready.
Get it together.
In heels and sequins stats. I'm telling you. Like I said, I feel like you said in my bio, I was like, I feel like I'm all over the place. It is some talk about.
My last question is, how have you been pursuing your outreach in terms of, well, let me better phrase this. When it comes to young adults, specifically, the library market is very important.
Yes.
And it can be hard to get into the library market when you are self-published, unless people do know you, people are getting their hands on your book, because of reviews and all these kind of politics involved. Mm-hmm. And Brooke earlier this year was talking about how nothing stopped her, how she went to universities. So from your perspective, everything you're putting into it and trying to reach out to librarians and bloggers, how have you pursued that? And how's been the reception?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I've done a lot of stuff on social media to try to get teens' interest. But what I mean, like, working from the inside out is I'm starting local and then ranking my way out, putting my feelers out. My little sister is turning 16. You know I hit up her high school. You're putting this in the library. Yes, please, principal. And then my high school, yes, please.
Of course.
Making a list of the high schools, making a list of the libraries. A lot of these things, you got to really think about it like high school. Mm-hmm. If your pop is good enough, you become popular when one other person thinks you're popular. That's it. So you need to get to position yourself to get your book maximum exposure in the right places, and then the rest kind of come from there. So that has also been picking up for me slowly but surely. I'm just make contacts, be kind, be gracious, do your research. And then when you're on social media also, don't be afraid to kind of be aggressive. If you see lists like, well, hey, on social media asking, especially if you know they're educators, on social media asking, I need a book. I'm going to Phoenix. I want to read something. Mm-hmm. You better go link your Amazon in there. Hey, try my book. And then pass it around to your educator friends. This is great for this age. I've got a lot of really great reception from that too. And then friending people that you know are educators or librarians or that sort of thing on their social media. Then we'll respond positively and then be interested in what it is. And then if you have something that's so desired that we're just really craving these positive images of African-American teens doing cool things and living their lives, you'll get that response. Just make sure that you're like kind of always ready, that you're starting from the inside and going out and you're positioning yourself to get the maximum exposure in the right places. And getting a publicist as an indie author, getting representation in the publicist also really helps in getting these people's attention.
It does, because some bookstore owners will ignore you.
And you know, we were talking about at the beginning of the conversation, but that stigma is real, so you need to actively be playing offense against the stigma as well.
I don't know. I mean, I'm in New York City, so it gets very petty very often. Where it's just like, we're competing against
the Chicago's kind of petty too, don't
worry. Yeah. And sometimes you just need your publicist to do it, whether you're self-published or whether you're traditionally published. Sometimes you just need your publicist to be that strong arm person to say, this is my client, and then they'll listen over you saying, hey, I actually have this book coming out, blah, 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 blah. Well, thank you so much, Imani, for being on the podcast.
No, me, I love this. This is so much fun.
It's good being on the other side, right? Well, how can people reach you, support you, contact you for panels?
Sure. So for me, all roads lead to Rome. You can find me. Make it easy for them, girl. Marketing 101. Make it easy. Go to ImaniJosie.com. There you will find links to all my other works that you can read my other short stories. I have a store where you can find The Blazing Star. You can purchase a signed copy or you can purchase a regular copy. And I'm on all social media. I am not creative on social media, so all of my handles are ImaniJosie. So I'm not hard to find.
No.
And I respond pretty quickly, so just bug me.
Josie, and that's Josie, Josey.
Yes.
And,
thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you. And read The Blazing Star. It's gorgeous.
Yes, it's so much fun.
It's unique. It's what we need right now. And thank you for listening, and talk to you soon.